Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival for 2021. My name is Claire Wright, and I'm a Professor of History at La Trobe University in Melbourne, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here to this incredibly timely and important session on women in politics. I'd like to note that I received the email to chair this session way back in February, actually in the same week that the Brittany Higgins story broke. So the Sydney Writers Festival director, Michael Williams, was either eerily prescient or the issue of what a volatile, hostile and harmful environment politics can be for women is, spoiler alert, not a new one. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are meeting on stolen land of the Gadigal people and that their sovereignty was never ceded. I pay my respects to elders past and present and thank them for their hospitality in allowing us to be here on their country today. It always was and it always will be Aboriginal land. Being Melbourne-based, I live and work on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, where the Woiwurrung word Womandjeka is used as a greeting. Womandjeka is generally translated into English as welcome. But I've recently learned that it actually means welcome, what is your purpose? And I think that's a terrific way of framing any coming together, whether that's of friends or strangers. And I'd like to invoke it today when our purpose is to ask the questions: how deep and wide is the gender divide in parliamentary politics? What are the costs of that gender political gap? And importantly, what steps might we take to effectively close it? Now, let me introduce our fabulous panellists. To my left, we didn't organise any of this, actually.
Well, Kathy did.
That's not true.
Actually.
Kathy colour-coded us pretty well.
Kathy organised how we were going to sit according to what we were wearing today, but we didn't ring each other up and say, what are you wearing? What are you wearing? To my left is Dr. Maureen Faruqi. Maureen is the Green Senator for New South Wales. She's a civil and environmental engineer and a lifelong activist for social and environmental justice. In 2013, Maureen joined the New South Wales State Parliament, becoming the first Muslim woman to sit in an Australian parliament. In 2018, Maureen became Australia's first Muslim senator. She's been a passionate advocate against racism and misogyny. Since joining the federal Senate, Maureen has been an outspoken advocate for public education, social housing, and animal welfare. She continued her work calling out discrimination in her first speech, condemning the legitimisation, normalisation, and encouragement of hate in politics and the media. She is the Australian Green spokesperson for education and lifelong learning, local government, gun control and industry. Maureen's book, Too Migrant, Too Muslim, Too Loud, will be released in July.
Hi, everyone.
Kathy McGowan, only geographically to my right, is a sixth generation farmer, a former teacher, the former president of Women in Agriculture, and one of 13 children in a family raised in the Indigo Valley in northeast Victoria. Kathy came to national attention when she won the seat of Indi as an independent in 2013, becoming the first female independent to sit on the crossbench. I will note 110 years after Vida Goldstein first sat for the Australian Parliament as an independent. During her time as a politician, Kathy actively worked in Parliament to develop policy around regional development, a National Integrity Commission, a code of conduct for politicians, as well as drought policy. In 2019, she was awarded the Accountability Roundtable Award for Political Integrity. She's an Officer of the Order of Australia, a Churchill Fellow, and, I might add, a Vice Chancellor's Fellow at La Trobe University. Her new book is Kathy Goes to Canberra, which is a better title than Kathy Does Canberra, I guess. And you can get this at the bookstore and it comes without sticky notes. You'll be pleased. You can add your own sticky notes. Please welcome Kathy to our panel. Kate Ellis, became the youngest woman ever elected to Australia's House of Representatives in 2004. 3 years later, she became the youngest ever Australian minister. In her 15 years in Parliament, as a member of the Labor Party, she held a number of portfolios as both a minister and shadow minister, including sport, employment participation, early childhood and education. Since leaving the federal parliament in 2019, she has researched and written a book about the experiences of being a woman in federal parliament. It's an absolute corker of a book, and it's called Sex, Lies and Question Time. It was published this year in 2021. Kate is also the number one ticket holder of the Adelaide Football Club, but we won't hold that against her.
Thank you.
Annabelle Crabb, you all know very well as a writer and presenter for the ABC. She's a keen amateur podcaster and co-hosts the, as she calls it, inexplicably popular Chat 10 Looks 3 with her colleague Lee Sales, who I'm reliably informed lends credibility to the exercise. Annabelle has worked extensively in newspapers, radio and television as a political journalist. She's won a Walkley Award for Stop at Nothing, The Life and Adventures of Malcolm Turnbull. She's published a best-selling book about gender and work, The Wife Drought. And in 2014, she published two cookbooks with her childhood friend, Wendy Sharp, the latest of which is Special Guest. Her most recent quarterly essay, Men at Work. And Annabelle is also the host and the driving creative and intellectual force behind the upcoming ABC documentary series exploring the impact of women in Australian Parliament over the last century. And you'll see that on your screens airing in September.
In July.
How exciting, much sooner than I thought it was. Please welcome Annabelle. Okay, now, I reckon that the degree of difficulty in chairing this panel is high because I think we should have been given half a day, not an hour, because each of these remarkably articulate and highly credible women could hold the floor for at least an hour on their own, if not more. But we only have the next 40 or so minutes, so let us get straight down to business. Maureen, I'd like to ask you the first question. As you're the current, you're currently a sitting member of Federal Parliament, can I ask you how the last couple of months of your working life have been? Given that your workplace has been described as toxic and dangerous, where bullying and harassment are endemic, and which is currently the subject of an investigation by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins. So is it fun to turn up to work?
It's never been fun to turn up to, the Federal Parliament, I have to say. It is a privilege to be there. And Kate and I were just having a chat earlier about that. I actually haven't wanted at all to enter that parliament for the last couple of months, since it was revealed as this house, which is supposed to be the house of the people of Australia. It has really been revealed as a house of harassment, bullying, sexual assault. And every time I've walked in there, my skin literally has crawled with absolute disgust. And, you know, imagine if I'm feeling like that, how are people who have experienced sexual assault, how are they feeling? And it's not just me, it's people all around me, you know, our staff. And not just the staff in the in Parliament, it's the staff who are in our electorates, in places where we're from. Everyone is feeling the burden and the disgust and the distress of it all. But it's kind of a reminder, you know how as women we're so used to in life, in this very patriarchal world, we're used to being harassed and bullied and just kind of, yes, we stand up and, you know, try and push people off from doing this, but we also, at one level, just brush it off and move on because we know that that's how the world works and we brush it off and move on. So the focus has really been brought back on this parliament, which actually drips in white male power and privilege. And you see it even, you know, it should be darker, brighter than ever before. You know, the power and privilege in the corridors of Parliament, in the chambers of Parliament, in the cafes where, you know, white men walk around as if they own that place. So it has been terrible, but I also know, and many of us know, that we have to be in there as well to change that terrible system and to dismantle the patriarchy and the white supremacy that lives and flourishes in there.
Mm. Patriarchy isn't going to smash itself.
No, it's not going to smash itself. And as a woman of color, I must add this, as a woman of color, I think the realization often doesn't hit the media or the general public, that there are layers upon layers on sexism that are above us. And for us to raise our head, we have to tear through those layers of white supremacy and racism, which isn't just doubled because racism and sexism intersect. It's many-fold over. It is many-fold over.
I'm going to come back to that intersection a little bit later. But, Kate, you were a federal MP for 15 years, and I want to make it clear right from the get-go that although your book is about all the reasons why parliamentary politics is not a level playing field for women, you do consider those years, and I'm quoting here, easily one of the most amazing experiences and greatest privileges of your life. But you do also acknowledge that there is a culture of silence among female MPs, what you call the unspoken code of not acknowledging the sexist and unfair treatment that has long bubbled away in the background of Parliament. And you've come to realise now that not calling out inappropriate and harmful behaviours isn't helping anybody. So why the code of silence, and why are you speaking out now?
Well, I think there's many reasons for that. One of them is that I actually found probably the biggest challenge when I was writing my book was to try and juggle the sense of, one, having to call out what is really inappropriate behaviour, and two, not wanting to turn women off wanting to go into politics. And I found almost with every chapter that I was grappling with, how can I call this out? How can I talk about this disgusting experience when I desperately want more women to go into politics? And I think in the end, what we have to acknowledge is that, you know, nothing changes unless you shine a light on it. But there is a code of silence in part because it's about acknowledging your privilege. Like, I was a member of Parliament. I was highly paid. I had access to a platform, access to power. I could speak out with parliamentary privilege. And so I always thought it's not my job to focus on me and what's happening in my workplace. It's my job to focus on the community that I represent. So it was only when I got out that I realised that the people who most need the parliament to step up, the women who are most oppressed, the women who are dying weekly, the women who are being assaulted, they need a better parliament. They need a parliament that has respect for women and will prioritise investing in programs that will help women. And we're only going to get that parliament if we shine a light on the problems and the things that need to change. So it's a balancing act, but it was really hard. And I guess in the end it comes down to, you know, I say, I don't want women to want to burn the place down. I want women to want to take the place over. And that's the line we've got to try and walk, I think.
Kathy, so in 2012, you were a constituent in an electorate that had a long-standing female MP, Sophie Mirabella. But together with a number of other disgruntled locals, particularly young ones, you began a non-party aligned community campaign to oust your sitting female member. If gender wasn't the problem in Indi, what was? And what was the cultural shift that you were hoping to achieve?
So there's a couple of things I want to just put on the table. My experience as a politician is not reflected in Kate's book. My experience was quite different, so I just want to put that there for a whole lot of reasons. But I think it began in the beginning, in that when we ran the campaign, there were in 2013 at that first election, there were 12 people who stood for election, and the leading five were all women. So Labor had a woman, Liberals had a woman, I was a woman, Greens was a woman, and another independent was a woman. And it was a really interesting observation that we all, in a country electorate, in a conservative country electorate. And it was really an interesting conversation that we had between each other, that gender wasn't an issue. And it would have been if we were going against the blokes. But because we were all women together, We could leave the gender and actually argue about why we were better representatives. So from the very beginning, that whole campaign was about who was going to be the best representative for our community. And it didn't have that subtlety. We were never weaponised about women. There was never, the media didn't pick it up. No one, it, in later elections, there was a bit of a conversation, but that first election, not. So there was a really different starting place. And so I got elected not as a woman, and I didn't have to fight the battles of gender, which I know about, but I got elected in a collection of women, that the community actually wanted what I was saying. Like, it was really close. There was only 439 votes in it, but it was close. And then that took me to Parliament, because my community had actually chosen me for what they saw and what they wanted. And that really impacted on my role in Parliament. So I never was in the situation where I had to, and because I wasn't in a party, I was always an independent, I could make my own space. And I got a bit of wisdom really early in the piece, an older, wiser countrywoman, when I was talking about how can I be an older countrywoman in Parliament? And she looked at me and she said, "Kathy, it's your competitive advantage." And I was so shocked, because I'd never seen that. And she said, "You're the only one of you there, and you know how to be in that situation. So play to your strengths as an older, wiser countrywoman." And I did, and it worked for me in a whole lot of different ways. And so there's two things I want to finish up with. One, it started really well. So I never had to, there was no pretense, there was no sense of being false. And then once I got in there and I realised that that was my competitive advantage, when Rebecca Sharkey got elected, the sisterhood, we worked together. And then when Karen Phelps got elected, we all worked together, we shared stuff, we made that work. And then when Helen Haynes got elected and Zali got elected, like, there's no surprise that those women are completely different politicians to the government and the opposition, because they can speak from a place of real safety and real security, because their communities have elected them for who they are, and then they get to be the voice of the community. They're not a voice that's translated and has to pay the cost of party. So I wanted to just put on the table early in the piece that there's a significant thing happening in our Australian politics now, and you guys as historians, I just really want to start ask you to observe Helen Haynes, Rebecca Sharkey, Jackie Lambie, and their voice and their power and their effectiveness is not weaponised. They're heard for what they talk about. Helen on integrity, Zali on climate, Jackie on veterans affairs. So I just wanted to put it out there that I think there's an absolute change happening. And then the final thing I want to just talk about it, to just get you to start saying, pay some attention to the change that we are seeing. Zali Steggall opened her Sydney office yesterday in Mosman, and I went there for that. And it was huge, you know, 70 or 80 people in those blue shirts. And I reckon 80% of them were women. And they were absolutely politicking. And the face of Zali and her campaign is just something, I've never seen it before. It's profoundly different. And I'm just saying, start watching what the chat, this 2000 COVID and the way we are is bringing a fundamental shift to women accepting their voice, accepting their power, getting out there politicking, campaigning, and getting the representatives they want. So, yeah, long answer.
That's great. Okay, Annabelle, so let's have a bit of an historical perspective here. One of the ideas that motivated the suffrage campaigners was that women would be able to clean up politics, and that this is why women should go into politics, indeed to clean up the mess that men had made of the world. And as you'd know, Edith Lyons, in her first speech in 1943, the first woman to get elected to the House of Representatives in Australia, referred to herself as a new broom. Drawing on that maxim, new brooms, they say, sweep clean. And this is what's known in academic circles as maternalist politics, that women will be the mothers of the world, cleaning up political houses in the way they cleaned up their own personal houses. So from the research that you've done, the interviews that you've done, have women made parliamentary politics any tidier, or have they destroyed the joint?
Okay, I love that speech of Enid's. It is completely infested with meaning, and she was the pioneer of something that we still see in politics today, which is women doing kind of extra work to make men around them feel relaxed about their presence. Because the other thing that she said in that speech was, this new broom isn't here to threaten any of the other brooms that are already in the cupboard. This new broom is going to play by the rules. Like, and there's so many women over the generations who have done that, and I think that that's one of the things that men in Parliament don't get about how women function in Parliament. They have to do an additional round of work to account for their own diversion from the norm. This question of whether women make parliaments nicer, like, really was part of the driving force behind the suffrage movement. There was an association with the temperance movement, so there was this strong suggestion that women who were against booze and gambling and all the nasty things that men do would bring this niceness to politics were they allowed to be admitted. And in fact...
Which is why white is the suffrage
right,
colour.
Yes.
Because white stands for purity.
Snow, purity, exactly. But it's a weird millstone around the neck of women who are in Parliament, because there is this sort of subterranean expectation that, well, you'll be nicer and you won't be, you know, prone to base politicking or terrible deals or whatever. And if you want proof of that, have a look at what happened, you know, in the 90s to Carmen Lawrence. It was actually called Saint Carmen, you know, in lots of newspapers. She was cartooned as a sort of like Joan of Arc figure. She was a person that was going to make politics nicer. And then, you know, when this sort of show trial was commenced against her, her perceived crime was that she had somehow, you know, made a political move, you know, back in Western Australia. It's a long and complicated story, which I won't embark upon here. But her central failure, as broadly perceived, was that she had been, you know, she'd sort of sunk to the level of base politics. Same thing that happened to Cheryl Kernow, you know, when she quit the Democrats. It was like almost like a moral crime that she'd committed. And I think that women continue to be judged by a higher moral standard than their male colleagues, and that's a real problem. I do think women as a group do operate differently in politics. I'm not saying that they are... I always resist the temptation to editorialise that they're, you know, more cohesive and they work together more. I think that they do, but not as a biological thing. It's just because of the terrain that they are obliged to negotiate. I think that the phenomenon, and I'm nearly finished, that Cathy talked about this sort of wave of women independents that are coming into the parliament is about actually party failure, I think, because like you're all sharking Liberal Party and National Party territory, right? Like, and I think when we look back at the last quarter of a century and the ways that the major parties have grappled with this question of women, you've got the mid-90s where the Liberal Party was doing much better than the Labor Party. They had about 25% representation. And part of that is because they've had quotas in the Liberal Party organisationally since the 1940s, which nobody, the Nick Caters of the world, never mention when they're doing their anti-quota rants. Anyway, I'm digressing. The ALP then, in the mid-90s, adopted quotas, have nearly reached parity, and I think what you're seeing with this movement is a rebuke from women, either consciously or subconsciously, for that party's failure to resolve this question. Sorry.
No, don't apologise. Never apologise, Annabelle. You know that. Maureen, I want to come back to this question that you raised before in a slightly different way. One of the strong themes that's come up in the last couple of months has been the idea of listening to women and the idea of voice, and that women have voices and that we are all need to listen to what they're actually saying. Is the culture of sexism in Australian parliamentary life compounded by racism in terms of the way that you are listened to. I read that one MP once accused you of using terrorist sort of tactics when you were simply raising a procedural point in a parliamentary debate. So how important is it not only to have women's voices added to the parliamentary mix, but also a diversity of women's voices? Does it change anything if we just include more white, private school educated female lawyers?
Yes, let me get into this one. So you talk about voices, and yes, women have voices, but I think what's also important is whose voices get the privilege of being heard. Heard by the media, heard within the parliamentary chambers. And that's where the rubber hits the road. That's where we know that's where the damaging effect of racism on top of sexism really affects women of colour. And, you know, we talk about this moment that we're having at the moment, and I think it's amazing the courage that has been shown by the women who have spoken out, the MPs who have spoken out. But it does also make me wonder that if this wasn't affecting the privileged, how much attention would it be getting? Really, what I really want is this light to be shone on other corners, outside the parliament as well. You know, hospitality workers, sex workers, cleaners. The media nor the politicians shine any light on that. You gave one example of, you know, something that happened to me. But for someone like me, parliaments are very lonely places. They're lonely places for a migrant Muslim brown woman. And I have worked, I'm a civil engineer. So all my life, my 25 years out of parliament, have been working in white, male-dominated places, like really masculine, patriarchal places. But I have seen nothing like parliaments, both New South Wales Parliament and the Senate that I work in. I have never felt so marginalized, you know, so kind of sidelined in a way as I do in this parliament. And it happens in very insidious ways as well. I mean, some quite blatant too, like my name. There are so many of my colleagues, MPs, not in the Greens, but outside, who just can't get my name right, even after you keep telling them what it is. One person in Parliament, in a community meeting, couldn't get my name right, and then just said, we should have simple names. You know, I mean, it might feel trivial, but it's not. I mean, a name is your identity. Getting it right, I think, is the first sign that you see the other person as an equal.
It's a microaggression.
Absolutely.
And if it happens over and over again, it's a macroaggression.
Yeah, and I'm in a place where there's consistently talk of banning Muslim migrants. There's consistently talk of multiculturalism having failed. You know, there is a consistent talk of, like, condescending ways migrants are talked about, and it probably isn't directed at me, but it feels very personal to me. So I think it matters in this moment of time, as we are striving for a feminist country, hopefully, as we are striving of this 100-year rule of men, white men in parliaments to be over and women to take over, that those women are not just white women, that there is a diversity. There should be, you know, First Nations women. There should be women of colour. They should reflect the people actually living in our society. Parliament is not at all a reflection of what happens in our society, and it can never do its job unless it is, because those experiences need to be in there and they need to be heard and listened to. Mm.
I guess within that diversity as well, we're not just talking about a racial or ethnic diversity, but even breaking the gender binary so that we're talking
absolutely
about trans women.
Absolutely.
And
trans
and non-binary
women, disabled women, non-binary women. It's like, when you hear people saying things like, you know, if you don't have a home, buy a home? Really? I mean, yeah. Yes, they have. They have said that. If you don't have, you know, if you're living on the street, why don't you buy a house? There are things like that, that education is a privilege. It is not a right. And maybe some of you don't agree with me there, but I think it's a right. But that's where the lack of diversity really matters. you know, issues like the one we heard yesterday about, where there's going to be now, people are going to be put into jail if they, Australians who come back from India are going to be put into jail. Well, why are these laws, these legislation, these policies being passed? Because those people are not in there representing their experiences and their views. So absolutely there needs that, but there's much more that needs to happen in Parliament. But it needs to start with the change of the people. That's the first thing we have to do to change the system.
Kate, Maureen touched on the media there, and your book makes it very clear that no matter how strong, loud, or even diverse female MPs' voices might be, they can't get their message across without media amplification. And the media, particularly social media, is not a friend of women. In fact, Julie Gillard told you during your interviews that if she could change just one of the three main sources of sexism she faced, Parliament, community, or the media, it would hands down be the media. So why is the media not only the problem, but also the solution?
Well, I think part of the issue is that if you're a member of Parliament, one of your, I guess, your KPIs is how good are you at getting your message out to the community more broadly. Now, if you happen to be a woman, then part of, a large part often, of the media coverage surrounding you is about what you look like, how big your nose is, how big your bum is, what your outfit is, how appropriate your shoes are. Which means that every column inch that is about those issues takes away from space that could be about the message that you're trying to get out. So it affects your effectiveness at doing your job. The media is also, you know, there is this relationship in Canberra between parliamentarians and the press gallery in particular. There's a number of people in my book that I don't name. I don't name the staffer who went on to be an MP, who when I was first elected said to me one night, in not these terms, how many men did you have to sleep with in order to be elected? You know, I don't name some of the people that did some of the most disgusting things, but I will tell you something. Often those same names you'll see in a newspaper with them being regarded as up-and-comers, because they're the people that go and background the journalists, that dish dirt on their colleagues, that spread rumours or that undermine other people in the parliament. The journalists get something out of that. They get information, and so they reward that person by talking them up in their columns and in the newspapers. And it is this toxic cycle where bad behaviour is actually rewarded. Which is why the media is a part of it. We can't say, why isn't the media reporting on the toxic culture in Parliament House? Because a lot of them, and certainly I'm not saying there aren't great journalists who haven't been fierce in the last few months and stood up and actually held their ground, but there is a culture amongst the press gallery more generally of being a player as well as someone who just reports on it. So as Julia said, if you can change one thing, what would make the biggest difference? Well, it would be a change to the media. And it's only by shining a light on these issues that I think we give them the opportunity to do that. Just last week, I had a message from a journalist who said to me that they'd been backgrounded about a member of parliament, that there'd been this dreadful rumour that had been spread. But she realised that she'd believed all of the rumours that she'd heard about me over the years and only learnt recently that they weren't actually true. So she decided to try something different. And she said, normally what I would do is I just wouldn't mention it, I'd accept that it was probably true and I'd move on. But this time she actually went to the MP and she put the rumour that was being spread about them to them, and she gave them the opportunity to, one, refute it, and to talk about the truth. Now, that takes the power away. When journalists actually do that one step, it takes the power away from the people that are trying to spread rumours and weaponise them to undermine their colleagues. And that's a really powerful change. So there are little things that can happen that can change the media culture. Or there are big things, like imagine, for example, if we talk about the number of women in Parliament, imagine if we had a look at who's sitting around at the talking about what's going in the newspaper each day, who's running the major media organisations. Imagine if we had some more senior women promoted there too. I imagine that would also have a very big impact.
And imagine if we have leaders of the parties who were women. I mean, the two big parties have men as leaders. Even my own party has a man as a leader. I mean, that's something we really need to think. I'm really hard about as well. Why isn't the one woman we had was treated so badly by the media and the politicians? That's the real problem in our society, the misogyny.
It really is. I think, just to take up your remarks about the gallery, I think you're right. And I think that some of the stuff that you have surfaced in your book and some of the decisions by people like Sarah Hanson-Young and Emma Hussar to talk about the really significant power of gossip in that building, right? And it kind of meshes in with another problem in the media, which is that, and it's a problem across politics too, that the default analysis or view or starting point is a male view, right? And so you don't necessarily get men who see the same issues that women do because they see it from a position of, you know, what they've always known. And the story of Parliament is that it's a building that was built to contain men and women have been sort of nudging their way in. But all of the presumed characteristics of the occupants are male until proven otherwise. I mean, like, in my series, I've interviewed a woman who was elected to the Australian Senate in 1974, and there were no women's toilets there in 1974. Like, and so that was one of the things she did when she got there. But I mean, there had been women there, they just weren't provided for in this really basic way. But I wanted to quickly read you the this only happened 10 years ago. It's a media headline that an intro from The Australian when Lara Giddings was became Premier of Tasmania, and, you know, Tassie went to the polls yesterday, so I thought it's like time for the 10-year anniversary for this intro. Lara Giddings says she's... Oh, the headline is, "Leftist Lara Giddings still looking for Mr. Right." This is... I'm not even making this up. January the 25th, 2011. Lara Giddings says she still hopes to meet the right man, but for now, she's happy to give all her time to being Tasmania's first female premier. Isn't that... Anyway. So, but before we close out on the press gallery, one of the things that has been massively exciting over the last few months is this sort of development of a story that lots of blokes early on said wasn't a story, right? So when Louise Milligan put her first Four Corners to air, there was a consensus, I reckon, across the gallery the next day, oh, it's not really a story. That stuff doesn't happen. That chick slept with her boss and regrets it and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Brittany Higgins heard that analysis and it made her angry, and that is part of the reason that she decided to go public. So I think about all these women and the journalists who backed her in and ventilated her story, Sam Maiden, Laura Tingle, all of these powerful women in the gallery who now are resetting our understanding of, like, what's a story and what isn't. And that is a really significant shift, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, Kathy, that makes me think of a phrase that you use in your book. You call it exercising the courage muscle, because, Annabelle, that's what you're talking about there. You know, Brittany Higgins, who obviously had learnt how the system worked, and then something tipped her over the edge to actually use that system in some way to her advantage. You talk about this exercising the courage muscle. And we don't necessarily associate courage as a value that an MP might need to have. We associate it with our ANZACs, or maybe possibly in this new context, our frontline workers. But tell us about courage and why and how you had to develop it.
So the book, Kathy Goes to Canberra, is taking the intellectual journey, in a way, from being an observer of politics to turning up, speaking up, and then stepping up into the responsibility of it. And every step along the way was a decision. Clearly, you all know that. But each one was harder and had greater risk. So that's a bit about what the story's about, my own personal journey. But what I learned along the way, and there isn't a mother in the world who doesn't know it, that it's worth doing, because at the end of it, you're changed, but your environment changes. And my electorate is now totally different to what it was before we did that. So it's, again, it's my call out to women in Australia to hear the story of your book and go, that's over now. We are now in a new space, because we women, and like Zali's women yesterday, we are going to be courageous about this and not antagonistic and not be brooms. We are going to be our best selves. We're going to call it out. And as the sisterhood and the menhood, we are actually going to be the change we want to see. And I just want to give you two examples of it, because it takes courage. It's all got a cost. But if we don't actually grasp that collectively together. So I want to just talk a little bit of an example of this. And again, I feel a bit outrageous saying this. But I had the unique experience in Parliament, and I mean, when I was there, of holding what they call the balance of power. And I tell you what, if you're a woman from the country, secure and safe because you've been elected, and you get a call from the Prime Minister to come and talk to him about how you're going to vote, and it's got nothing to do with gender, it's got everything to do with I want your vote, what do I have to do to get it? One thing. And then the media, again, in that balance of power time, the whole media was respectful. You go back and you look at, there was no weaponising of me, or I can't speak for Karen Phelps, but certainly not me or Rebecca. And I shouldn't just say that. There was the Daily Telegraph did do one thing. But generally speaking, I'll speak for myself. I felt I wasn't weaponised, and they didn't do that to me. Now, not to say I didn't do it to anybody else.
Were you ever in a cartoon in bed with anyone who you'd made a deal with?
No, never.
Because that used to happen to Cheryl all the time.
But what I want to say is, if we want to change this, just imagine this time next year, after we've had this election, if there are the women of the quality of, Rebecca and Zali and Helen Haynes and a few others of you good women here who've won as independent and collectively hold the balance of power, and you're women of strength and courage and knowledge, and hold the power of being represented, this would change overnight. We would no longer have this discussion. The media would change, because these women know how to work with the media on that level. They know how to call it out. We know the stories of the past, and we know how bad it was, so we're not going to go there again. So it's my call out to Australia, is we actually could change this with having, I'm saying, women of quality and courage and capacity and principle holding the balance of power and deliberately doing it. And on climate change, on integrity, and they get elected on those platforms with the job of actually doing the work. And every time, I'm going to say, the Liberal Party or the National Party says we're not going to do it, if they're still in government, these women say, well, that's the end of that. We're going to not, you don't get the vote anymore. But I think what we've actually underplayed, which I hear in the history, is the power of our vote. We haven't been strategic about saying politics works on numbers. How do we get it? And I just want to do a call out to New South Wales. And my sister Ruth and Women for Election Australia have been doing these workshops around New South Wales, teaching women and running workshops about actually how to do this, how not to be what you were brought up to be, in a way, the broomstick and working around blokes, but this new way of working is claiming your space, being courageous, and being the person you want to be, like being the change you want to be, like not apologetic about being a woman, being strong and proud, and doing the work that you know needs to be done for the country. And I love the fact that that's being taught or workshopped, so that the women who are coming through who've actually got the grace and the strength, and they know about courage, and they know about sisterhood, and they know about racism, they actually know that stuff, and they're not going to fall into the trap of playing that game in the future. But the key is having the numbers in the parliament to call out the other stuff. And then everything else falls into place. Like Murdoch would fall into place if we had that. What do you reckon?
I'm in.
Amen. All right. Okay, we're getting very close to your questions now. I told you we're not going to have enough time because I've still got about 4,000 questions of my own. But I want to ask each of you the same question to wrap up. Kate, one of the kind of most, there are so many striking and shocking things in your book, but one thing that really hit me, the current gender composition of our parliament is 32%. It's not a great number, but it's an improvement when you consider that in 1980 it was 2%.
Although the Senate is now more female than male.
That's right.
Which is
right? Amazing, yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
But you cite a 2017 survey showing that 0% of women aged 18 to 25 would consider entering politics as a future career. 0%. So I'm going to ask each of you, we've talked a lot about the cultural obstacles to women exercising power through parliamentary politics, but if you could nominate one concrete structural or systemic change that might encourage women to enter politics, what would it be? Let's go with you, start with you, Kate.
Oh, thanks for starting with me on this one. I think it's, I mean, I actually disagree with Cathy that there is one solution, and that is electing independent women to hold the balance of power. Like what we, sorry, Cathy, but I actually think that, like, one of the reasons why I didn't want to write a party political book, I spoke to women from across the political spectrum, is because if we actually really want to see this change, if we want to change the culture within Parliament House, it has to change across the board. I want to see more talented women in the Liberal Party. I want to see more talented women, you know, promoted to leadership in the Greens, in the National Party, across the board. So I think that the one thing that can change is how about we move away from this conversation we've been having for decades about quotas or targets and, you know, and actually just accept that you need to put in place structural reform to bring in more women. And once you do that, the culture will change itself. And once you do that, you have reform. I don't want the country to be great for Australian women once every 10 years when my party's in government or when someone else is in government. You actually need to change it across the board if you're going to smash the culture that exists within Parliament House at the moment. So we hear this argument all the time against quotas, where people, where we see women, conservative women, who have come out and said, I don't want people to say that I'm only here because of a quota system that was in place. Well, I'll give you a newsflash. Every woman that I spoke to who's been elected to Parliament has been told, in my case, I was only there because I must have slept with hundreds of powerful men in order to make my way there. Other women were told they were only there because of who their husband is and that a favour was owed to him. You're actually judged on a whole range of things regardless. So I think bite the bullet. Let's actually have structural reform to make sure that we finally close the gender gap across the board in Parliament House would have the biggest impact.
Maureen, 1 minute, one structural change.
I mean, we're still 100 years away from gender equality. That's what the research tells us. And I, for one, am not going to wait for that. So, you know, we have to, at every single, stage, change things. I mean, I'm very proud of my party. We have 60% women in our party room. And that is because the party has structures to encourage women to put their hand up. I think we could do better. I think we could have more affirmative action. I have nothing against quota systems. I think they go hand in hand with other structural reform. But I think Kate is absolutely right. We have to actually remove the barriers that stop women from doing this. A few that Kate pointed out, others are, you know, political parties joining them. When do they have their meetings? Simple things like where do they have their meetings? That can be a barrier for women. So it starts in terms of getting more women into parliament. It does start with political parties changing the way they do things, opening up, having affirmative action, having quota systems. But then it shouldn't, again, I come back to this point, while we are doing that structural change, it just shouldn't be a structural change for gender equality. We can do many things at the same time. It has to be a structural change to make Australia a feminist and an anti-racist
and an equal country for every single person who lives here. Let's do it all together. We have the capacity to do it.
Annabelle, what is one thing that you've seen happen over the last 100 years that has made a difference?
Yes.
Or say what you were going to say then.
I just wanted to raise a voice for extra structural change. Like, I think one of the weird things about Parliament in the last decade is that there are some issues where the community has kind of led the Parliament rather than the other way around, or even like the business community. So like marriage equality is one really important example of that, but also on climate, like the growth of renewable energy in this country has sort of happened despite the Parliament rather than because of it. And I think that what's happened in the last few months, is you've seen these powerless young women changing the Parliament and changing the discussion and changing the audibility of what is said and can be said and what is heard and what is powerful. Like Brittany Higgins, bottom of the stack, really, in terms of the power structure of Parliament House. She had nothing to lose her because it had already been taken from her. So her powerlessness actually became this mighty weapon that she used. And like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez in the States, who displaced a very powerful Democrat incumbent because she had nothing to lose. All she had was her direct relationship with her community. And that, to me, is really inspiring. And I think that that's not about structural change. It's actually about external pressure and the growth of a new head of power, which is one of the most exciting things of this year, I think.
Mm. So you can clearly see I'm not a great fan of the parties. They want structural reform. I'm a great woman for action. So two things that I think we could do is support Women for Election Australia and get young women to do that course. It's a really good course and do it. And then the second thing is mentoring them to stand for election. State, local government in New South Wales is coming up this year, then the state and then the federal. And it's if we put our minds to it to support, encourage and get on the team for quality, skilled women to run for politics, we could do it. My sense is wanting the parties to reform and restructure is a bit like asking, I'm going to say something about God or heaven or religion. You know, it's a long time coming. But if we use our courage muscle and we step up, we could do this quickly. But it's going to take us talking up about politics and getting the candidates that we want who say, no, I couldn't be a politician like I did. And for the young people to say, Kathy, well, the end of that, you know, we're going to get behind you and you've got to go and do it. No, we want you there. And if we did that, we would actually change it. And it's possible and it's easy and we've got elections happening now, but it's do we want it enough? And I don't, I'm hearing the talk, but I'm actually not seeing, I saw it actually in Sydney yesterday, as I said with Sally, those people wanted enough to be in the streets in their blue shirts and saying, we want more of Sally. But what about Bradfield? What about Wentworth? What about North Sydney? I don't know what electorates you come from, but do you want it enough? Are you prepared to get out there and find the candidates that you really want to represent you as opposed to some of the mediocrity you're currently getting? Are you brave enough for it?
Thank you all for coming along today. Please thank all of our four panellists. Please buy these marvellous books. Look out for Maureen's book coming in July, Annabelle's series coming also in July. Use your vote, step up, use your courage muscle.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.